This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome to our American History segment. We've been exhausting the American History magazine and the Civil War Monitor magazine in the last few weeks. Given what's going on in the world today, I found an interesting article that I think you'll find very timely. It's entitled, How the SAS Suddenly Became the Most Famous Special Forces Group in the World. And it really is based on April 30th, 1980, when gunmen took over Iran's embassy in London. There was a six-day siege that was ended on May 5th when the SAS stormed the building after hearing shots inside that building. It was an interview with Ben McIntyre. So this is from the History Magazine, December 2024 issue. So the context is, on that April 30th, 1980, six gunmen from the Democratic Revolutionary Front for the Liberation of Arabistan stormed the Iranian embassy in London, taking 26 people hostage. The terrorists, who ultimately wanted independence for Khuzestan, an Iranian province with a substantial population of Arabs, which are actually a minority group in Iran, sought concessions from their government, which had taken power in the revolution of 1979. A six-day standoff began, and the Metropolitan Police negotiated with the gunmen. In the meantime, the SAS prepared to free the hostages by violent means, the media gathered. On May 5th, three shots were heard inside the embassy, and the body of Abbas Lavassanani, an Iranian official, was pushed out of the building. Fearing for the lives of those still held captive, the government ordered the SAS to carry out Operation Nimrod, in which teams of SAS soldiers burst into the building. All but one of the remaining hostages, Ali Akbar Samadzia, were rescued, and none of the SAS men lost their lives in the assault. Five of the six terrorists were killed. The lone survivor, Fawzi Baldi, spent 28 years in prison. Okay, so for the interview. Rob Attar asked the question to Ben. The Iranian embassy siege is one of the most significant events in modern British history. What new insights do you want to bring to the story? Ben replies, the siege was highly significant, but it's also one of the most heavily mythological events in modern history. Many see it as an example of great SAS daredoing, which it was, but it's actually much more complicated and much more interesting than that. If you ask the average person what the siege was about, they would probably say it was after the Iranian Revolution, so it was about Islamic fundamentalism. Which it sort of was, except for those six Iranian Arabs who took over the embassy in 1980 were actually fighting for autonomy within Iran. They were opposed to the Ayatollah and his new regime and chose Britain as a target because they believed Britain was sympathetic to their cause and that they would get a fair hearing. So there's a lot of misunderstanding about what happened. And I loved writing the book because it's a story that takes place in an enclosed theater. 26 hostages being held effectively in one room inside this building. It's a story about what ordinary people do in absolutely extraordinary circumstances. So what should we know about the Middle East in 1980 to understand this story? The 1979 Iranian Revolution, in some ways, is the most important event of the latter half of the 20th century. It changed everything. If there'd been no Iranian Revolution in the long run, there'd be no Iraq War, no Afghanistan invasion, and no 9/11. International terrorism would have taken a very different shape, and the modern world would be completely different. In 1980, none of this had settled down. The Iranian regime was highly unstable, and some of the participants in the revolution were looking for support from the Ayatollah's regime. Among them were the minority Arabs who lived in the corner of Iran that contains most of the oil, Khuzestan. Persians comprise the largest ethnic group in Iran, with Arabs making up a few percent of the population. They had supported the revolution and believed the Ayatollah was going to come through with a promise to give them individual rights and self-government to some extent. Not only did that not happen, but the Ayatollah's security forces clamped down ferociously on a kind of Arab insurgency that was going on there. From that emerged from this little group, these six men trained in Iraq and backed by Saddam Hussein, who decided to stage a terrorist spectacular in central London. They attacked the Iranian embassy, which was staffed and occupied by Iranians that were supportive of the Ayatollah's regime. It was intended to be a direct attack on Tehran in order to persuade the Ayatollah to release political hostages. It was a battle taking place between Iran and Iraq, but on the streets of London. The demands of these terrorists seemed to be to have actually shifted during the siege. Did they have a clear idea of what they wanted to achieve? Rob asks. Ben replies, these were people who had been fooled. They believed, and they had been told by the Iraqi intelligence service that they would stage this occupation, they wouldn't have to kill anyone, and they would be able to enable the release of fellow Arabs from Iranian prisons, and then they would be flown back to the Middle East. It sounds like a very naive assumption, but it was not without precedence. This was a period when terrorist spectaculars could prove successful, and perpetrators were, in some cases, able to persuade governments to fly them back to safety. In fact, Britain in the past had done that. Under the Heath government, there was an example of a Palestinian guerrilla, Laila Khalid, who had hijacked a plane, been captured in Britain, and then sent back, and she's still alive today. So, we think of these terrorists, people who have little communication about employing violence. But these six men were keen to avoid killing the hostages, weren't they? Ben replies, that's correct. They were a complicated crew, though. These were men of violence. They were men who had been brutalized by events in their own pasts. In several cases, family members had been tortured and murdered by the Iranian security services, although that doesn't forgive or excuse in any way what they did. They were prepared to kill, and they did kill. But they did not, I suspect, want to kill. This time around, Britain wasn't prepared to negotiate. How integral was Margaret Thatcher to the approach taken? Margaret Thatcher had been in power for less than a year and had not faced a major test of this sort. But the troubles in Northern Ireland were approaching an appalling crescendo, and she knew that she was going to have to face terrorist problems. The siege became the template for the way she would deal with them. Thatcher made it clear that while she was happy for the police to keep negotiating, she was not going to let these people, who had already committed crimes simply by breaking into the embassy, to get away with it. They were not going to be allowed to fly away. So there was a complete disconnect between what one side wanted and what the other side were prepared to grant. He was asking, there's also another government of whom demands were being made. Was Iran prepared to grant any concessions? Ben replies back, absolutely not. Here one has to put this into context. As the siege was taking place on the streets of London, the American embassy in Tehran was also under siege from a militant students, a lot of whom purportedly worked for the Ayatollah's security services. So while the Iranians were creating their own hostage situation with Iran, you've got this satellite one happening over here. And of course, the U.S. was putting pressure on Britain to achieve a successful outcome to the siege in London, in the hope that this would encourage the Iranians in Tehran to free their hostages, the U.S. hostages, there. Rob asks, the negotiations carried on for days. What impact did that have on the hostages? It was astonishingly tense in there. You had this extended standoff where relationships began to emerge between the hostages and the hostage takers. There's lots we can say in terms of the Stockholm Syndrome and those effects. But there's also the reverse, which is the Lima syndrome, where the gunmen develop relationships with their captives to the point that they are unable to continue and fulfill their aims. Plus, there were emerging relationships between the gunmen and the hostage negotiators, a handful of police who were working the telephones and other methods in trying to contact them. The siege was the biggest media story in the world. Journalists flew in from all over the globe, and an entire press encampment was set up in Hyde Park. There was intense media scrutiny, which, of course, added to the stress on all sides. As you say, the hostages and the hostage takers grew quite close. Why was this? It's a familiar pattern, I'm told, by people who have studied this. What happens over time is that many instances, the hostages come to see the hostage takers actually as their protectors. It sounds contradictory, but they come to see the police outside as working against them, talking too long, not providing the answers, not acceding to what they begin to perceive as the hostage takers' perfectly reasonable demands. And certainly in the case of these 6 days, some of the hostages began to see the hostage takers as a quite sympathetic light and vice versa. Some of the younger gunmen began to feel a great sympathy for the people they had taken captive. And as time went by, they started to share food that had been sent in from the police. They began to discuss their lives with each other. It was an extraordinary moment when they'd all been sent in some takeaway food, and one of the hostages said, "We need to celebrate this moment." He said they should all sign a memento, so he tore up those takeaway boxes, and everyone signed their names with a little message to each other. What strikes me is just how friendly these messages between hostages and hostage takers were. At the same time, one of the gunmen found an Instamatic camera in a drawer and took what only can be described as souvenir photographs. It looks like they're having a picnic together in this extraordinarily enclosed world. Of course, they had no real idea what was happening outside. They didn't know the SAS assault troops were ready and waiting in the next room. Now, as you've hinted here, the SAS eventually ended the siege in a violent manner. Is there a way this could have been done bloodlessly? Ben replies, "It's difficult to speculate, but I'm in agreement with Professor John Gunn, who was the police psychiatrist on the scene, that if they'd been able to keep negotiations going a little longer, the whole thing might well have crumbled because the gunmen were so exhausted and they were beginning to fall out among themselves. The police had inserted eavesdropping equipment into the building and were able to track the relationships between the gunmen, and it was clear those were beginning to break up. Perhaps things would have worked out differently had the negotiators been able to accede to one of the gunmen's requests. One of the things they wanted was for Middle Eastern diplomats to come and talk with them. They wanted to be taken seriously. Margaret Thatcher did not allow that to happen, and the diplomats themselves really weren't keen to do it. But it's my belief if they had been brought into those diplomats, then this might have been resolved." So Rob asks, how much preparation was required for the SAS operation? The SAS was largely unknown in Britain at that point. But since the terrorist activities of the early 70s, some of which had been handled very badly by the authorities in other countries as well, the British government had set in trained contingency plans should a similar operation be required. And the SAS had been training intensively for this for many years. They trained in buildings in Herefordshire called the Killing House. They mocked up hostage scenarios with cardboard hostages and cardboard gunmen in different situations. They might be in the dark. It might be full of smoke. There might be gas bombs going off. And the SAS would have to break in and try to neutralize the gunmen, save the hostages. Believe it or not, the royal family undergoes training here in order to experience what it would be like to be taken hostage and then liberated by the SAS. The SAS were ready and had trained heavily. The only thing they'd never actually done was carry out a hostage rescue operation like this. The operation came with huge risks. How difficult a decision was it to authorize the SAS to storm the embassy? Ben replies, "It was a terribly difficult decision. For the policeman in overall charge of this operation, John Dello, It was a terrible moment. Because the police believed that two hostages had been killed, they felt they had to hand over to the SAS to carry out what was codenamed Operation Nimrod. It was the lowest moment of Delaware's career because he felt that he had failed. The police had hoped to end this standoff bloodlessly, but this became impossible. Peter de la Baire, the director of special forces in Britain, had warned that there were likely to be 40% casualties at best. And despite the fact that this was an incredibly well-planned operation, floor by floor, minute by minute, man by man. Rob asked, in the end, the storming of the embassy was far more successful than it was originally feared it might be. To what do you attribute that success? It was about 50% luck. Even today, the soldiers who participated in the operation, and I've interviewed pretty much all of them, say they were incredibly fortunate. Bullets were flying everywhere. Grenades were going off. Tear gas was spreading throughout the building. The SAS were attacking front, back, through the roof, and up through the basement. It was dark. It was filled with smoke. It's amazing that only one SAS soldier was slightly wounded, and they got almost all the hostages out. The other 50% was very careful planning, very good training, and courage. The SAS did what they were trained to do, and they did it spectacularly well. You can argue that they did it a little too well in the sense that they went hand in hand, very hard indeed, and there have been inquiries about the nature of what they did. But I think everyone agrees they were given a brief and they carried it out well. Rob asks, and this was all unfolding live on television. How unusual was that? Ben replies, I was a 16-year-old schoolboy at the time, and I was watching the World Snooker Championships between Alex Hurricane Higgins and Cliff Thornburn. It was getting quite exciting, and actually, then, suddenly it cut away to this live footage of men in black overalls and balaclavas ascending down the outside of the building, bursting their way in, smoke bombs, machine guns, and hand grenades. It was just the most extraordinary sight. A younger generation will not really believe this, but we were not quite used to seeing live news like that. And it just didn't happen. Then suddenly it was being broadcast live on all three channels. Rob asked, how did these siege affect the SAS? Well, the SAS suddenly became more famous, the most famous special forces group in the world. Other governments began to ask the SAS for help, and they were lent out to other countries to carry out similar operations. Meanwhile, the numbers of people applying to join the SAS rocketed. These were people turning up at recruiting centers saying, I've seen those television pictures. I want to be one of those. Some in the SAS think the Iranian embassy siege actually was a disaster for them because it turned out that the SAS, from being a secret organization to something everybody knew about but wanted to know more about, it created a situation that they still wrestle with in their an intensely secretive organization who nonetheless flourished on their own mystique. They've always slightly caught between wanting to be a secret and wanting to tell their stories. Last question, what was the legacy of this siege? Ben replies, there was a perception that the successful conclusion to the siege would somehow encourage the Ayatollah's government to look more kindly on Britain, and more specifically to look more kindly on American hostages it was holding in Tehran. Nothing of the sort, however, took place. The Iranians were not going to be swayed by this operation, although they were pleased with the outcome. One long-term impact is the taking of diplomatic hostages kind of stopped. Terrorist groups began to aim away from diplomatic premises in the belief that it wasn't really going to work. Plus, the siege really did set the stamp on Margaret Thatcher's approach to terrorism. Her attitude toward the IRA hardened massively with all the consequences that we know sprang from that. That concludes the article. Thank you. Let's see where we go next. So let's go to the magazine All About History. And there's an article. It's an interview, actually, with Dr. Robert Lyman, who is an author, historian, and fellow of the Royal Historical Society biographer of Field Marshal Bill Slim. He's interviewed by David Williamson in this magazine, and the title of it is, What If Japan Had Actually Invaded India? So, setup. 1944, the war in South Asia reached a critical moment when the Japanese offensive threatened Allied control of northeastern India and beyond. So by the end of 1942, Britain was really reeling from a series of devastating defeats at the hands of a rampant Japanese offensive, most significantly losing the fortress city of Singapore and retreating from Burma. However, in 1943, Brigadier Ord Wingate launched the first of several special forces raids into Burma from neighboring India, targeting Japanese positions and infrastructure. The Japanese high command set in place a plan, Operation Yugo, to invade Manipur, northeast India. Capturing key strategic positions in the region would cripple any hopes the Allies had in recapturing Burma and could even galvanize a significant Indian nationalists movement keen to see the end of British rule. So let's kind of look at the past first before we go into the interview, and then we'll look at what if. So what actually happened was in spring 1944, Operation Yugo failed. The Japanese were unprepared for a prolonged campaign. They were harangued by Lieutenant General Bill Slim's fighting withdrawals and undermined by his own divisional commanders. Lieutenant General Mutagachi's offensives at Imphal and Kolmai ended in failure. The loss of over 50,000 casualties is one of the largest defeats for Japan in the war. Mutagachi is blamed for the failure of the operation and subsequently relieved of command. By autumn 1944, the Allies advanced into Burma. With Assam secure, the Allies make tentative incursions into Burma in late 1944. They were slowed by the monsoon season. Amphibious landings along the Arcanian coast and islands led to Slim's 14th Army crossing the vital Irrawaddy River in February. Slim advances across Upper Burma. Mandalay is recaptured after hard fighting in the 19th Indian Division in March 1945, enabled Slim to push southward. In 1945, Rangoon was captured. In April, Lord Mountainbaum launches the long-planned Operation Dracula to recapture the critical capital of Rangoon. The combined air and sea operation meets little resistance, and the city has already been largely abandoned by the Japanese. An Allied victory parade is held on June 15th with further plans to recapture Malaya. The Tokyo government surrenders unconditionally to the Allies on September 2nd. So that's what's actually happened. The point of this article is there's a really different possibility. So let's look at that. So let's say in spring 1944, the Japanese were victorious. Realizing the Allies will seek to delay and attrite his forces, Lieutenant General Mutagachi convinces his divisional commanders to make a swift and bold attack, bypassing well-prepared pockets of resistance in order to capture Imphal and Kolyma. Sensing the great opportunity, General Kawabe Masakura agrees to Mutagachi's request to follow up the air attack with a strike on the logistics hub at Dimpur. His forces suffer large casualties, but Mutagachi's gamble pays off, and Slim's defenders are forced to withdraw. If that happened, by autumn of 1944, there'd be a march on Delhi. Britain's inability to defend its positions in northeast India galvanized support for the Subhas Chandra Bose nationalist movement, buoyed by the Indian National Army's role in Operation Yugo. Through Bose's promised march across the country does not materialize. Massive uprisings put more pressure on the Raj regime, which is desperately diverting resources to protect its interests. This further weakens Britain's control of the region and governance in India. By 1945, China would be cut off. The threat of Japanese advance as far as Dimapur forces the USAF to eventually abandon Hump Air Bridge across the Himalayas. This leaves the Chinese leader, Chiang Kai-shek, with thousands of tons of arms and material for its own war efforts against Japan. With Burma secure and the British and Indian forces in disarray, Japanese commanders are now able to consolidate their positions, commit more resources to their conquest of China, and defend against the Allied advances in the Pacific. So that's the possibility that we're going to talk about here. So let's get into the actual interview with Dr. Robert Lyman. So the interviewer is David Williamson. So David asks, by the end of 1942, Britain was reeling from those series of devastating defeats at the hands of the rampant Japanese offensive, most likely significantly losing the fortress city of Singapore and retreating from Burma. What were Japan's aims when they launched Operation Yugo? Dr. Lyman replies, when in early 1944, Tokyo authorized Operation Yugo and its associated feint towards Chittagong Operation Hago, the avowed purpose was to deny the princely state of Manipur for the Allies for any future operations into Burma. It was from Imphal, the capital of Manipur, that then Brigadier Ord Wingate had led the first Chindit operation in February 1943. The strategic rationale for the Operation Yugo was merely to extend the Japanese outer defense perimeter across the Chinwin River into Manipur, the home of the 4th Indian Corps, which had constituted the mainland threat to the Japanese control of Burma. Operation Yugo was not to constitute an invasion of India. The air cover supplies and troops necessary for such an undertaking didn't really exist in Burma in 1943, and General Mazakure, commander of the Burma Area Army in Rangoon, did not want to commit himself to an operation for which he had inadequate resources. Lieutenant General Madoguchi, commander of the Japanese 18th Division, harbored a desire to press on into Assam. His evaluation of the British position in Northeast India showed him that there were three key strategic targets in Assam, and that was Imphal, the headquarters of the 4th Indian Corps, the mountain town of Kawami, that straddled the only road into Manipur from the valley, and the huge supply base at Dimapur, 74 kilometers northwest of Kawami, which held sufficient stores to sustain an army on the offensive for several months. Kawami, in the mountains north of Imphal, really guarded that route to Dimapur. If it were captured, Imphal would be cut off from the rest of India by land. From the outset, Mutagachi believed that with good wind, Dimapur, rather than Kawami, should be secured. He reasoned that capturing this massive depot would be a devastating and possibly terminal blow to Lieutenant General William Slim's ability to defend Imphal. That would also be a blow to supplying General Stillwell in northern Assam to mount an offensive into Burma in 1944 or 45. There were some 30,000 men who were mustered for this long trek to Imphal, along with 12,000 horses and 1,030 elephants. Field Marshal Count Teruchi agreed to Mutagachi's plan in September 1943, and a senior staff officer was dispatched to Tokyo to persuade Prime Minister to authorize this plan. Tojo gave Mazakau strict instructions to ensure that the 15th Army went no further than Imphal. Masaki also gave detailed orders to Madoguchi on 19th January 1944. The commander of the 15th Army was instructed to mount a strong preemptive strike against Imphal before the onset of the monsoon season, which is mid-April. So I asked Dr. Lyman, why did the Operation Yugo fail? First, the Allied 14th Army fought harder and more expertly than the Japanese had expected. This meant that they were forced to spend more time than they had envisioned fighting and getting into the Imphal plain to capture Allied supplies. The Japanese were good at fast, fleet-of-foot campaigns where they bypassed sources of enemy resistance to seize logistically important or strategic points to the rear of a defended area. During Yugo, however, they were dragged into attritional battles they simply didn't need to fight. If they had bypassed defended positions and kept their main effort at getting into Imphal itself, of capturing Dimapur, they would have won a great victory. That's the thrust of this article. If the view of the historian, they could have easily really done so. Second, the Japanese were undone by the 14th Army commander, Lieutenant General Bill Slim, designing a stratagem to exhaust the Japanese in attritional fighting long before they reached Imphal. It worked. First, he withdrew his two forward divisions, the 17th Indian and the 20th Indian, into Imphal, undertaking a fighting withdrawal on both the Titium and the Tamu axis that severely degraded Japanese offensive capability in this area. He reinforced Kaming and used air transport to sustain a massive program of supply to Imphal. It was Operation Stamina. And of flying out non-combatants. Allied access to air power was critical to Slim's success. Third, none of Madoguchi's three divisional commanders, 15, 30, and 33 divisions, believed in the plan. And two, at least, of the three worked actually to undermine it. Yanagata, whose task it was to seize Titium and advance on Imphal from the south, was horrified at the high cost to his division of the defensive withdrawal undertaken by the 17th Indian Division and refused to be rushed, undertaking a methodical advance that allowed the 17th Indian Division to fight its way back successfully into the Imphal perimeter. At Komini, Sato refused to wholeheartedly support Madoguchi's attack on Dimapur. Finally, Madoguchi's assumption that his troops could not move quickly enough did not have a substantial logistical plan proved to be a fatal flaw. A significant proportion of Japanese troops died of starvation during their campaign. Ooh. So the next question is, how might Operation Yugo have been successful? The invasion could have worked if Madoguchi had allowed to drive for Dimapur. Instead, he was forced to pull his punches at Kamini, the great strategic possibility of removing Dimapur from Allied control was lost. If Dimapur had fallen, the Allies would have struggled to sustain operations further north at Lido, the start point of the hump airlift to China, and would have also been unable to build up forces in Manipur to launch subsequent operations into Burma. Masakuzo was not thinking strategically when he refused to countenance Madoguchi's request to fall on Dimapur, a decision which led directly to the overall Japanese failure by forcing the Japanese to fight a sustained attritional campaign at Komina, which they simply were not prepared for or even suited for. So, how important were the Indian Army national movements to Japan's plan? Dr. Lyman replies, the veteran Bengali nationalist Subhas Chandra Bose told Mutagachi in 1943 that a Japanese invasion of even a small part of India, propagandized as a march on Delhi to free India from the oppression of the British Raj, would spark a nationalist bushfire which would be unstoppable. Bose promised Madoguchi that the troops of his Indian National Army, INA, recruited from the troops captured in Malaya, Singapore, and Burma, would accompany Japanese liberators to give the invasion legitimacy in the eyes of the Indian people. It was a powerful argument, If Dimpor had been captured, for instance, by a force that included INA troops, the political effect across India would have been profound. But Madoguchi acknowledged the power of this argument. Japanese commanders had little time for the INA, and on the whole, used them badly during the campaign. They undertook offensive operations in their own right on only a handful of occasions and achieved nothing of material substance. They ask, did British and Allied forces have a plan on the place on the event of a Japanese victory? British really had no plans for managing the fallout of a Japanese victory simply because it was not a possibility of Plan B in northeastern India. If Impala and Kamini, but not Dimpor, had been lost, the Allies could have continued to support the hump operations from Leto, but would have been unable to undertake any operations into Burma until the Japanese had defeated from the positions they held in Impal. This would have been an enormous and difficult operation, only possible the following year, 1945, with the prospect of an advance into Burma after that. If the Japanese managed to capture Impal, Komina, and Dimpor, it would have been game over for Allied operations in northeast India and probably would have severely curtailed or even ended the hump operation as well. So David then asks, was a wider Indian uprising against British rule more likely if Japan's invasion were successful? The Japanese had no strategy to exploit the capture of Impala and Kamina beyond Mutagachi's bright idea to capture Dimpor and so facilitate a Bengali uprising by virtue of the arrival in India of the INA. It is certainly possible that a further uprising against the Raj would have been possible in 1944, but it would not have been extensive. Indian nationalists on the whole were scared of Japan and they saw their route to independence via a handover of power from Britain rather than a handover of power to Japan, whom most saw as simply another imperial power. Most nationalist opinion in 1944 in India was clear-eyed about the threat Japan presented to the achievement of independence. David then asks, how might defeat at Impala and Kamina affected British and Allied strategy? The loss of Impala and Kamina would have been devastating for the Allies. Militarily, it would have meant the failure of Slim's defensive strategy, and it would have meant the failure of the considerable efforts undertaken through late 1942 and all of 1943 to rebuild the Indian Army and to prepare it for war against the Japanese. The Japanese occupation of Manipur and perhaps its debauchment into Brahmaputra Valley at Dimpur and Gujarat would have demonstrated the continuing failure of Britain to protect India from enemy aggression, fatally undermining British credibility within respect to the security of its colonies. Likewise, a Japanese victory in 1944 would have made it impossible for the Allies to reconquer Burma and thus meet its strategic aim of restoring Burma Road to China. This would have critically undermined Britain's relationship with China. Chiang Kai-shek was distrustful of British willingness to engage wholeheartedly with the challenge of removing the Japanese from Burma and thus reducing the enormous pressure on China. And finally, it would have left a legacy at the end of the Second World War in which the Japanese armies in the field in Asia would have remained undefeated. And this would allow Japanese nationalists to claim that it was only the atomic bomb in Japan that really forced the Japanese to surrender. Totally different outcome to World War II. Thanks for listening to this article. For the next article, found something interesting staying in that history museum, magazine, excuse me, and it's called The Tyrant and the Usurper, Richard versus Henry. So the history of the English monarchy took a really startling turn when Richard II was overthrown by his cousin, who seized the throne as Henry IV. But, as Helen Castor explains, the ousted king was an untrustworthy narcissist, an ineffectual warrior, and the architect of his own downfall. Sounds like an interesting cousin rivalry. So the article. On October 13, 1399, a coronation took place in Westminster Abbey. It was the feast day of Edward the Confessor, the royal patron saint of King Richard II. The gilded tomb Richard had commissioned, in which he intended one day to lie beside his dead wife, Anne of Bohemia, stood close to the confessor's shrine. Near the high altar, a life-size portrait of the king glowed in the candlelight. But Richard was not there in the abbey. He was under lock and key in the Tower of London, and the man sitting on the throne that day was Richard's cousin Henry, newly crowned as King Henry IV. It was not supposed to turn out like this. 22 years earlier, when Richard had just become king at the age of 10, Henry, just 3 months younger, stood beside his chair at the coronation feast, holding the ceremonial sword of justice. The symbolism here was clear. As the boys grew up, Henry would succeed his father, John of Gaunt, Duke of Lancaster, as the greatest nobleman in England and the chief supporter of Richard's crown. Back then, it was impossible to imagine how disastrously the cousins' relationship would break down, to the point that Henry would depose Richard to take the throne for himself. What had brought England to such a crisis, and why were these two boys so closely related by birth and upbringing become such different men? In 1377, England had been united in grief at the death of one of the boys' grandfathers, Edward III, one of the greatest kings the country had ever known. Edward's eldest son, Edward the Black Prince, the hero of England's ongoing war with France, had died a year earlier after a long illness. England's people transferred their loyalty without question to the Black Prince's son, Richard, as the true heir apparent of the realm. The difficulty was now working out in the realm how it should be governed until Richard was old enough to rule for himself. In theory, the obvious answer was that John of Gaunt, the king's oldest surviving uncle and kingdom's most powerful magnate, should serve as regent. In practice, though, Gaunt was too unpopular. Unfairly suspected of wanting to make himself king in his nephew's place, and at the same time too powerful for anyone else to do the job. The only workable solution was to fudge the issue. Officially, there would be no minority. The 10-year-old king would rule. Unofficially, decisions in the king's name would be made by his nobles. A young man growing to maturity who understands the duties as well as the powers of his crown might have come to understand why misrepresentation of political reality was necessary and what he was required to do to take command when the time came. However, Richard was not that man. For as long as he could remember, Richard had been told that he was special. As his father's only surviving legitimate child, he was unique and irreplaceable. His mother, Joan of Kent, had been married before. As a result, he was also the cosseted baby of a family in which he, unlike his four older half-siblings, stood alone in the line of royal succession. But Richard had never seen kingship in action. For as long as he could remember, his father and grandfather had been too ill to lead England's government. Now, Gaunt and the other lords trying to keep the war effort going faced growing complaints about their military failures and high taxes. In their attempts to unite the country, they presented Richard to the Parliament as a boy sent by his grandfather in the same manner the scripture says, "Here is my beloved son. Here is he who is wished for by all men." Several seasoned politicians might recognize this overblown rhetoric, but Richard heard the message that he was England's Messiah. And 4 years later, amid the chaos and violence of the peasants' revolt, the teenage king found that Wat Tyler's revelers were looking for him alone to the lead. They stood with King Richard and the true commons against what they saw as corrupt and failing government. Richard agreed, but his conclusion not that he must learn to rule his people well. He had no interest in fighting to defend his kingdom. In the hard work of negotiating peace, or the importance of law and justice. Instead, what had gone wrong in England, he believed, was that the nobles had usurped his own God-given royal authority. To Richard, the decades-long conflict with France, now going so badly that the treasury was empty, England's territories on the continent were under assault, and the South Coast were repeatedly damaged by French raids, this was a tedious irreverence. In 1384 and 85, when Gaunt tried to defend the North against the Scots and find terms for peace with the French, Richard and his favorites were plotting, unsuccessfully, to murder him. In 1386, with Gaunt gone now by fighting abroad, a parliament led by Richard's youngest uncle, Thomas of Woodstock, tried to force the 19-year-old king to focus on the imminent and terrifying threat of invasion by a French armada. Richard's furious response was that he would only ask for help against Parliament's insolence from his cousin, the French king, and rather submit ourselves to have him than succumb to our own subjects. It was a shocking demonstration that Richard had grown into a thin-skinned narcissist whose understanding of power was entirely focused on his own will rather than the needs of his people. Richard's English cousin saw matters entirely differently. Like Richard, Henry was his father's only legitimate son, but unlike Richard, he had not grown up in royal isolation from his family of strong-willed siblings. Henry had two older sisters, a half-sister from his father's second marriage, and four half-single siblings, three boys and a girl, born to Gaunt's mistress, Catherine Swinford, a warm and intelligent woman who, after the early death of Henry's mother, Blanche of Lancaster, took charge of the bustling Lancastrian nursery. Where Richard's education was a protective cocoon, which was exposed to neither physical danger or intellectual challenge, Henry was destined to be demanding preparation for the responsibility he would inherit as Duke of Lancaster. His military training began when he was young. He learned to joust at his father's side, to lead men in peace and in war. He loved books and music and won admiration wherever he went. He was gracious, good-natured, courteous, and loved by all, a chronicler in France later noted. He also understood the dangers loomed when a government was not functioning well. During the Peasants' Revolt of 1381, while Richard was discovering the unique powers of his crown, Henry was almost killed when the rebels overran the Tower. He was saved from death by the kindness of a small holder from Kent, whom Henry remembered for the rest of his life. He saw at first hand the relentless efforts that his father made to defeat England's interests through diplomacy and war, and how bitterly Gaunt was rewarded with plots to destroy him. Then, in 1386, 19-year-old Henry was entrusted with the safeguarding of Lancastrian interests while Gaunt was abroad. Sitting in Parliament, he supported the idea of council led by Thomas of Woodstock, Edward III, youngest son, taking over the leadership of the government in order to resist French invasion. Richard happened to be ignoring. To English relief, the weather thwarted the invasion, but given the extremity of Richard's threat against those who had tried to make him recognize reality, in the council's work continued. Henry watched as Richard responded by removing himself from Westminster and by declaring that all those who had supported the council's appointment should be punished as traitors. So, when Richard returned to London in November 1387, his threats prompted Thomas of Woodstock and the earls to arm themselves against him. They were trying, they said, to remove the favorites around the king who were the real traitors to the realm. This deflection of blame from Richard himself was a desperate attempt to protect the three lords from the charges of treasons. It also reflected the fact that Richard had no obvious heir, no son, no brother who could replace him on the throne without risking England descending into anarchy. No deflection could avert the confrontation that was coming through, and when it became clear the negotiations would not work because Richard's word could not be trusted, two younger lords joined Woodstock, Arundel, and Warwick in rebellion: Thomas Mowbray, Earl of Nottingham, and Richard's cousin, Henry. This was the fork in the road. the moment that would determine the path of Richard and Henry's relationship, and with it, the shape of England's future. Henry led the forces that defeated Richard's favorite, Robert de Vere, at the Battle of Rodcott Bridge, and drove de Vere into exile. In 1388, what became known as the Merciless Parliament, Henry and his allies charged Richard's closest advisors with treason and presided over a spate of executions. They were playing a profoundly dangerous game in the hope that the king might learn a necessary lesson. Richard had no choice but to comply until, in 1389, he reclaimed his place at the head of normal royal government, helped by a newly returned and always dutiful Gaunt. An uneasy peace was restored, during which Henry took the opportunity to seek adventure, put some distance between himself and his cousin. He went fighting on a campaign in Lithuania with a crusading order of Teutonic knights and traveling as a glamorous pilgrim through the courts of Europe to Jerusalem. Richard, meanwhile, sought himself to be free from the financial and political constraints that had forced him to submit to his subjects' controls. A permanent peace with France could not be found, but a 28-year truce sealed in 1396 by Richard's glittering wedding to the 6-year-old daughter of French King Isabella of Valois called a halt to the war. And all the while, he was building up a military knight, a private army of knights and archers who swore his badge of white hart and answered only to his personal authority. The lesson he learned, it turned out, was not only one of his subjects had hoped for. In 1397, the king made his move, grasping for the power that he always believed he should be having. Woodstock, Arundel, and Warwick were arrested and charged with treason for their actions 10 years earlier, actions for which the pardons they had received were not, in Richard's brave new world, worth the parchment they were written. Warwick was sentenced to life imprisonment, Arundel executed, and Woodstock murdered behind the walls of his Calais prison. Although untouched so far, those rebel lords, junior partners of 1387 and 88, Henry and Mowbray, were terrified of what might follow. While Richard tightened his grip on the kingdom through military force and judicial insecurity, fear drove Henry and Mowbray to accuse one another of treachery. Richard decreed that the truth should be tried by combat. But when the two men came to face at the lists at Coventry in 1398, the king stopped the duel and banished them both from England. It seemed that no royal judgment and no royal promise could ever be trusted. Richard declared that the exiles would be allowed to take possession of any land they might inherit, but once again, he lied. When Gaunt died, heartbroken, in February 1399, the king took Henry's duchy of Lancaster into his own hands. Believing that he had destroyed the power of the cousin he hated, Richard sailed with his army for Ireland, where he had previously enjoyed watching the Irish chiefs kneel in homage before him. But Richard did not realize that in disinheriting Henry, he had destroyed his own power. If even the greatest nobleman in England could not rely on the protection of the law against the king's will, then no one could. England looked for rescue to Henry, the Eagle Duke, as he was called by contemporaries, after one of his badges. When Henry landed at Ravenspur in Yorkshire with a small band of loyal followers, England's people rallied to his banner. By the time Richard returned from Ireland, his kingdom was already lost. Richard still had no son to succeed him. The Eagle Duke, his first cousin, a fine soldier and an able leader, was the only possible candidate to rule his place. On October 13, 1399, the crown was placed on Henry's head in the Westminster Abbey. But the one attribute of sovereignty Henry lacked was the one Richard still had, birthright. A king who had become a tyrant was replaced by a king who was an usurper. That meant Henry's throne would always be vulnerable. Just how vulnerable it became less obvious 3 months later when a handful of nobles who had been the closest to Richard rose up in revolt. The rebellion was put down, but the danger of a living former king was clear. Within weeks, it was announced that Richard had died in his prison, starved to death, rumor said. In order to save England from Richard's tyranny, Henry had not only done what his cousin had always feared, usurped his power, but committed the sin of regicide. A man who believed in justice and the sacred authority of kingship had been forced to violate both in his attempt to preserve the kingdom. The rest of Henry's life would be spent trying to escape Richard's shadow in the hope that good government, God's blessing, might one day justify his claim to England's crown. I've got a couple minutes left, so let's think about women in Victorian England, right? We've got an image of what they were in our own mind, but let's take a look at one, Alice Diamond, who is decidedly different. So, while Peaky Blinders, Brighton Billy Boys, and Charles Sabini's mob terrorized the streets of Britain's major cities, there was another equally notorious all-female gang whose shoplifting sprees brought havoc to London's West End. The 40 Elephants, named after thieves in the legend of Ali Baba, and their geographical home, Elephant and Castle, were active about the 1880s. By the mid-1910s, the gang had a new leader, Alice Diamond, alias Diana Black, described in the newspaper at the time as the Queen of 40 Thieves. Alice was born in 1896 in a workhouse infirmary and grew up alongside seven siblings in that grim tenement. According to the 1911 census, Alice had begun working as a servant when she was 14 years old. This was an age of growing opportunities for some working-class women to get into better-paid employment, factories, offices, and others, domestic servants, dressmakers, laundresses, and found themselves stuck in low-paid work, unable to participate legally in new forms of leisure and consumerism. The new West End department stores, with their accessible displays of ready-to-wear clothes, proved an irresistible temptation to many. Some shoplifters worked alone. Others formed group, and for Alice and her gang, shoplifting became a career. New members were induced and trained. All had to abide by a hoister's code, which bounds them to support each other, share proceeds equally, and abstain from drinking before a raid. As Metropolitan Police detectives explained, the women would dress up and descend on a West End store like a plague of locusts, practically cleaning the place out inside of an hour. Stolen clothes, fabrics, and furs were rolled up and stuffed inside their bloomers, pants with giant pockets. Getaway cars transported the ladies back to Southwark, where they would sell the clothes as quickly as possible. Alice didn't always get away with it. She appeared regularly before the London magistrates and served several numerous short prison sentences between 1915 and 1936. Still, at the peak of her career, Alice was making about $30 a week. It's a small fortune in those days. She spent the money on glamorous clothes, expensive jewelry, and entertainment, leaving almost nothing behind when she died in 1952. So, fun little detour there into female criminals. Again, appreciate you joining us for history, and we'll see you next week.